Hello and welcome to the Tortoise Shack. Today we have a very, very special one on trade unions and organised labour. Now, Tony, unfortunately, is not with us. He will be coming back at some stage. But in his stead, we have Rachel O'Neill. Rachel, thank you very much for coming in here and taking his place.
Thank you very much for having me, Martin.
Our guest today is Communications Officer with Mandate Trade Union, David Gibney. David, lovely to have you in. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for the invitation.
So I'm going to start off with the anniversary has just passed of the Tolpuddle Martyrs. Now, I can tell you that the Tolpuddle Martyrs were agriculture workers back in about 1833 who organized labor. They tried to organize their labor and they were deported to Australia for doing so. And that was the beginning of the trade union movement as we recognize it these days. But you've an interesting follow on from that, David. Mm-hmm. You were in Australia. You worked in trade unions in Australia.
I did. I worked for two unions in Australia. One, the United Voice Union, and the other one is the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union. The Tolpuddle Martyrs and the whole issue began in 1833. But if you read Labour in Irish History by James Connolly, he explains about the penalties for joining trade unions in both Ireland and in Britain between 1802 or 1803, I think it was, actually, after the Emmet Revolution, all the way up to 1847. The penalty was deportation to Australia.
And they used this secret organisations, this very archaic piece of law about secret organisations, and that's what they used to deport them.
Yeah, so probably using Emmet and the 1798 rebellion as an excuse to say, you know, if you're going to organise anything. Now, bear in mind, so those revolutions here in Ireland were a threat to the empire. But the threat to the empire was the same as a threat to the capitalist class at the time, so who were in charge of the empire. So the biggest threat to the capitalist class of the time was obviously trade unions and organised workers. So what you had was thousands upon thousands of British and Irish trade union members who were being deported to this one area, a small corner of the world with a very small population, and all of them arriving in the likes of Melbourne and in the 1830s, 40s, 50s. And on the back of that, then you had...
They were chagrined by their experience and they decided not to be trade unionists anymore as soon as they landed. I presume that's what they did.
Yeah. They all became capitalists. Some of them did, actually. But the vast majority didn't, obviously. And one of it's known as the foundation of democracy in Australia. The Eureka Stockade happened with the gold miners up in Ballarat and in Bendigo. It's a long story, which I won't get into here. It's worth looking up, though, because it's a piece of Irish history, actually, because the leaders of a guy called Peter Lawler, who was the brother of James Fintan Lawler, the Fenian rebellion, or Fenian rebel, he led the stockade along with, and this is what's so inspirational about that revolution in the 1850s, 1854, I think it was, was that it wasn't just Irish and, you know, Europeans. There were obviously Europeans there. There was an Italian involved in it. There was three Americans, and it shows you how racist America was back in the day. Two white Americans and one black American. And when the trials were taking place of these 12 leaders of the rebellion, the American president wrote seeking a pardon for the two white Americans, but didn't seek the pardon for the black Americans. So I think we've gone back in time now with Trump there. I'm sure he'd do exactly the same thing. But anyway, from that 1854, the Eureka Stockade, they managed to get the vote, universal vote, voting rights. And then, 2 or 3 years later, in Melbourne on a semi-warm day, probably the same temperature as it is today, the workers all decided it's too hot, 27 degrees it was. We're downing our tools until we win the right to the 8-hour day, 8 hours work, 8 hours rest, 8 hours play is what they were looking for. Very first city in the world who won the legislated 8-hour day, which they still celebrate today.
And then the 8-hour day swept across trade union movements right across the world. That became the standard, was 8 work, 8 play, 8 sleep. Mm-hmm. And that became the standard for workers right across the world. What happens since, what happens since?
So employers are constantly pushing back, and this is a feature of capitalism, that they want more work out of you for less pay and longer hours. And
and it's just announced today we have the most productive workers in the world today. Production is up, I think, is it 34% year on year this year?
Mm-hmm. So how are they measuring that?
About the same way they measure GDP.
Yeah. I don't trust the figures. I do a lot of training courses with our members to explain this, because Irish workers generally are very low paid, but Irish retail workers in particular are extremely low paid. Highest prevalence of low pay in the entire EU, second highest prevalence of low pay in the OECD behind the United States of America. And we're always told here by employers, you're well paid, highest minimum wage in Europe, or we're the third or fourth highest minimum wage in Europe. But what they don't tell you, Michael Taft has done lots of great research on this, is you shouldn't be measuring the headline minimum wage rate. You should be measuring employee compensation, which, you know, Irish employers get a huge tax break in the form of low PRSI, employers PRSI. They pay about one third of the average EU country's employer PRSI rate.
We're the second cheapest country within Europe for hiring employees, second only to Malta. Mm-hmm. Malta is the cheapest place to actually hire workers. If you want to hire a worker in Germany as an employer, there's a fairly hefty tariff on hiring their workers. In Ireland, all we got here is PRSI. Mm-hmm. It's 10.7.
For the high earners,
it's 10.7%. And in
you
fact,
don't pay anything up to €353 or something.
That's right.
Like that.
And for the vast majority, for increasing numbers of employers are actually avoiding PRSA altogether.
Yeah.
And then the downside of that for everybody who lives in Ireland is that your pensions now are going to be linked to your PRSI contributions going forward, and you may not qualify for full pensions in the future.
And you have the added benefit, for example, is that, in workplaces I know, you don't actually get pension contributions until you've been with a company for 2 years. So if you are hopping around in industries where requiring to hop around is where you kind of go to get the increases, you're kind of screwed.
Well, that flexible work that everybody supposedly loves, that's...
Not even that, just that, if I go to another place, I might get better pay. It's like, oh, you're starting your pension contributions all over again. It's like, well, I've just settled for the fact that I'm never going to get a pension at this rate.
Well, at least that goes with never going to get a house, never going to get a car.
My expectations are very low.
And you're right about the public pension system, which is constantly being eroded, you know, in real income terms. But here's something that very few people have been talking about, particularly in the trade union movement, that 2022 is when they're starting to bring in this auto-enrollment pension scheme. And the whole point of that will be to get rid of the public pension system entirely. And, you know, we need to delve into it and look at the policy and make sure that it's representative of workers and that it does what workers want it to do. Because I'm extremely fucking pissed off about it, to be honest, because they're bringing it in. It's an auto-enrollment scheme. So the employer is going to be, and the employee are auto, you know, enacted into this pension scheme. It's going to work out after about 4 years. A worker is going to have to pay 6% of their wages towards this pension, right? And the employer matches that with 6%. Fine. I'm all for people having paying into pensions and all that sort of stuff. I have two problems with the actual scheme, which are really serious problems, is that it's going to be completely publicly funded, as in the state is not going to do the investments. You're going to be forced to put into a private pension fund, which may be investing in war munitions, cluster bombs. It'll just invest in whatever the best return of the day is.
It's sterling. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But it's really annoying in that that's happening, that I'm going to be forced as an employee into a pension scheme that will not have any ethical obligations whatsoever. We will be invested in war all over the world as private pension funds currently are, right? That's one element of it, is where is my money going to be spent? I want to know. This is, by the way, pensions are not something that an employer or the government gives you. These are deferred earnings. This is what this is about. This is about a bit of money you're putting aside, your own money.
Yeah.
And what I would say is that it should be democratic. It should be trade unions in Australia are on the boards of every single superannuation fund. My old superannuation fund over there had 13 people out of 24. There was a board of 24 in Australian Super. 13 of them were trade union leaders and officials dictating where investment went. So they tended over there at that time when I was there to invest in clean technology, right? So ethical. They're looking for jobs in clean technology, manufacturing industries, creating jobs that are about saving the environment. Here we're going to have a bunch of people in suits dictating where my money goes, and generally the most profitable industry in the world tends to be munitions or water, which is providing the double the dividends than any other industry in the non-financial services sector anywhere in the world at the moment. So that's the first thing. Where's my money being spent? And then where the contribution comes from. Why should a worker have to take a 6% pay cut in 5 or 6 years when the employers are already currently getting the lowest, among the lowest employee compensation? So as a trade-off, I would be proposing that because you have low employer PRSI rates, you're going to pay the whole fucking pension.
Well, this actually came up recently. There was a discussion within the Department of Social Welfare when they bring all their heads together and they bring a few people to have a chat with. And they were discussing PRSI. And we know now that people who are self-employed are entitled to certain benefits under, because they pay, whether you're employed, self-employed, you pay the same PRSI. It's no different. An employee pays the same as a self-employed person. Right. It's the lion's share comes from the employer, the 10.7%. Yeah, yeah. That's where it comes from. But to properly fund, for self-employed people to properly fund what they'll receive from the pension fund, they'd have to be paying 12%. Mm-hmm. That's what they'd actually have to be paying into it. And social welfare have said, well, you know, sooner or later, we're going to have to work towards this 12% figure for all self-employed people. So it's great now. And everybody's going, yeah, really happy with this. 2 years from now, 3 years from now, you're going to be paying 12%, 12%. Welcome to capitalism. Mm-hmm. I think it's unreal. And there's been no discussion. Zero. Nobody has discussed this.
Yeah, it's not a sexy topic.
No, it's not a sexy topic. But for the likes of lads in construction, which is a huge, you know, well over 100,000 people working in construction, and the vast majority of them are labeled as contractors or subbies or whatever it is, they're going to see a real drop in income of 10%. Mm.
Yeah.
A real drop. And that's just around the corner. And it'll probably hit them at the same time as the next recession comes through. So they'll have a lovely double whammy there.
Yeah.
That's going to really help the housing crisis as well. Because once you lose that 10%, I don't know where you can afford to live after that. Like if I lost 10% of my income, I'd be in Leitrim. I don't know where else I'd end up. Like.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because part of the plan, or that I would be proposing as part of this whole pension, mandatory auto-enrollment pension scheme, would be, think about this, the amount of money, 6% of everyone's income going into these funds. Why not set up a fund that specifically invests in cooperative housing or public housing? And it's a long-term investment over 50 to 100 years that, you know, and this happens in other parts of the world where a pension fund will be sitting there. And what you're doing is young people, 22, 23 years of age, start in this pension fund and it actually funds their housing for the next 40 years.
That'd be ideal.
You know, and since independence up to 1966, there was a rule in the corporation and all the councils across the country was that you couldn't spend more than 25% of your income on accommodation, right? Let's get back to that. Let people pay a contribution through, you know, even if it's through a pension fund, or if the state's refusing to do this, we can do it through our own pension funds. Build public housing, people, whatever, if you're low paid, you're higher paid, 25% of your income or 20% of your income goes into this fund. And then that bit can then fund your pension when you retire.
It is a great idea. And I mean, it has changed. So the acceptable used to be 25% and the acceptable level now is 33%. And why it changed from 25% to 33%. And even though we know that 33% is just this fictitious figure that they'd love to be at, but you're looking more at double that figure.
Oh, I pay 47% for my bills and rent put together.
I spoke to one of our members from Tesco yesterday, who's currently spending 100% of her income on accommodation, 100%. And she's being evicted in October because the landlord wants to sell the place, and they cannot find anywhere else to live. I won't name the town because she didn't want to be known, but I've come across heaps of our members who've already been made homeless, most of them working in Tesco. It's our biggest, we have more members there than in any other company. But I've met in Cork, in Galway, in Dundalk, and in Meath now, members all working in Tesco, all being made homeless or currently homeless. One's living in a caravan. And so unions,
their scope goes beyond just organisation of labour.
Yeah. There's no point in us winning, and we have been winning, very successful in winning pay increases for the last 5 or 6 years. We win a pay increase and then the landlord increases the rent or more house prices go up. So we take the view that we need to have a more rounded approach to trade unionism. You don't stop being a trade union member the second you walk out of your business, the place of employment. This is why we were involved in the Right to Water campaign, was we had won pay increases for members. And what was happening was then the government, stroke of a pen, takes that pay increase that they have. Some of them had to go on strike to win those pay increases. So they're going, well, what's the fucking point in battling for pay increases when somebody can just take it back off us? So we have to be out there, both in the industrial sphere, winning the pay increases, but also making sure that you know, the free market doesn't erode it, or the government doesn't come in with an unfair, aggressive tax that's going to eat away at it.
And that brings me nicely on. I'm going to bring us forward a few years from where we were. I'm going to bring us right up to the 1950s, the early 1960s in America, which is seen as the golden age in America. It's when Trump talks about make America great again. That's the great. That's the great he's talking about. When you had a growth, this huge balloon.
I know you're going
middle,
with this.
In middle class wealth. You had a huge balloon. But that balloon in middle class wealth was entirely matched by a growth in union membership. And since Reagan, what you've seen is both those indicators drop at exactly the same rate. Middle class wealth and union membership are parallel lines heading towards the ground. And it goes to show that without union membership, middle class wealth disappears. And yet in Ireland, it's the middle class who are most opposed to union membership.
I don't know whether that's true. I mean, when you talk about middle class, like, some people find it very difficult to understand what middle class is. And so I'll just throw it out there. My impression of middle class is like, you know, professional industries, doctors, and 100% of doctors in Ireland are in a union. 100%. Highest density level that you'll get.
I would disagree in that
now, they don't like other low-paid workers' unions.
No, I would disagree. I would agree that doctors who work in hospitals are certainly in unions. I would disagree that GPs are in unions.
Well, they're in professional organisations, yeah, almost all
not,
of them.
Not unions.
Well, I don't know about their negotiating licence, whether they have one, right?
They have. They have negotiating. They have the right. They won the right.
Now, see, you're being pernickety about interpretation of trade unions. Absolutely. IBEC is a trade union. Like every employer in the country, every major employer is a member of a trade union. Right. So, you know, the smartest people, professional footballers, they're all in unions.
We'll call it organised labour.
Yeah, but they're organised and it works for them and they get benefits out of it. And the people who are not organised are the lowest paid in the most vulnerable sectors. People in retail, hospitality services, working in restaurants and hotels, the cleaners that we have. They're the people who don't happen to be in unions. And it's not necessarily because they don't want to be in unions, because of the victimization towards them for being in unions from the people who are in unions themselves. So, for instance, Tesco implementing an anti-union plan called Project Black to break the union, make sure nobody in Tesco is a member of a union anymore, yet Tesco is a member of IBEC. It's okay for the boss.
Yes.
It's not okay for the workers. And this is what we're up against in the lowest paid sectors of our economy.
And we saw that what's happening in Tesco was predated back to the late 1960s in the UK on construction sites when everybody was working in the black economy and the employers simply refused to call them employees, just simply refused. So the UK authorities said, all right, look, we'll come up with this special class of worker where they're not exactly employees, they're not exactly self-employed, but what we'll do is they'll get a little bit more in hand, they'll get more allowances for gear, for whatever, and the employer pays nothing towards the employee. So zero investment from the employer, and they called it subcontracting. And that's where it came from. And that practice then moved back to Ireland because it was Irish navvies working over there, so they came back here, and it started here. And very quickly, and I mean very quickly, the entire construction industry changed from employee-based to self-employed-based. And then we had the PRSI marches, where people who pay PRSI, the PAYE worker said, why are we shouldering all of this burden? Why do we pay for all the services when there's this vast group of people, mainly the employers, who are getting away with murder? And it started a process which began and then suddenly stopped. And now we have a much higher number of people who are not paying in compared to what they had then. And yet the PAYE worker is extremely quiet about it. Never says, why is the burden on us? Why is all the burden on us.
Mm. And a lot of that is down to unions not being active in the political sphere itself.
And that's just where I was coming to.
go on.
To Rachel earlier, I figured the PPF was the worst thing that happened to unions in Ireland. The absolute worst thing that happened to unions in Ireland was being in partnership with government.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of reasons for that. Firstly, they lost the ability to fight.
Mm-hmm.
They lost the ability to actually have a dispute. And there's a generation or two generations of workers who have never known what it is to have an industrial dispute.
Mm-hmm.
So the skills are lost. Those people who knew how to go out there and do it no longer exist. Okay, there's people like you coming through who are reteaching. But you had to come from...
No, I went on strike in 2004, five.
Yeah.
It's a topic, right? Mandate trade union. Our predecessor was IDATU. We campaigned in 1987 against partnership. We campaigned against every partnership agreement that came about. We lost in the democracy within the trade union movement. Everybody else was included, but mandate wasn't throughout all those years. We were not in partnership. Neither were Unite. CWU were opposed to a number of them. So it was the big unions generally that carried these partnership agreements across the line, which I'm fundamentally opposed to all of these agreements. I think they're terrible. As you say, people lost the will to fight. But as I said, we went on strike in 2005. When I started doing communications work for Mandate, 2007, we were involved in a strike in Argos seeking a €1 an hour pay increase. We've been involved in a lot of strikes before the collapse of social partnership and all the rest of it. But it's generally stuff you don't hear about because the mainstream media like to feed you this thing of, you know, there's no industrial disputes going on over here.
Yeah.
Like it's all quiet on the Western Front. No, it is, to be fair. We've declined in terms of the amount of days off.
We're at the lowest level of industrial action since going back to the
1979. Peaked it. So, days lost to industrial disputes, which is the term that the government uses. Last year was the lowest since 1922, right? Since they started the records. Most of them from last year was just 1,600 or something. Most of them was us on strike in Lloyd's Pharmacy and in Tesco. We did a strike in Carrick and Shannon Tesco and Sligo Tesco last year, and then we had 11 days of industrial action in Lloyd's Pharmacy. We never shy away from industrial action. But we were basically the only union really involved in industrial disputes last year. Contrast that with 1979, 1.4 million days lost to industrial action, right? Now, I wrote an article about this a while ago, about 3 or 4 years ago. The years, when we had the highest amount of strikes, 1977, 78, 79, were also the years that coincidentally that we had the highest wages as a proportion of GDP, right? Coincidentally, which were also the same 3 or 4 years that we had the highest trade union density levels. And the argument I was making is when you have active unions, when you have unions fighting for pay increases, fighting for improvements in terms and conditions of employment, and they're going on strike, people join them. People want something to fight for. They want something to win. And when you provide them with an avenue where they can win, then yes, they will join unions and they will get active. And we saw it in Dunn Stores in 2015, we went on strike. Our membership went from 3,000, just under 3,000, 2,900 members, all the way up to 5,600 in the space of about 3 months.
Yeah.
People were going, we're going on strike, we're going to win pay increases, we're going to do this, that, and they won. They won legislation change there, the Employment Miscellaneous Provisions Act. They won 3% pay increase every year for the last 5 years.
Well, you see, when you talk about organised labour, and I'll just take an example of the minimum wage, when you talk about organised labour, that means that workers hold the power. And you're going back, I mean, this might sound funny, but you're back to Citizen Smith. You're back to power to the people. And you got to ask yourself, why is it that it's so unbalanced at the moment? Why is it so unbalanced in favor of employers at the moment? Now, I know, and I said about PPF being really bad. Well, the proof that it was really bad was when austerity hit, unions were picked up by the scruff of the collar and put outside the door of Leinster House and said, we don't need to negotiate with you. At the one time when workers absolutely dreadfully needed a voice at the table, they weren't allowed it because of PPF.
Yeah.
And that's what happened.
Yeah. We'd lost all of our key activists in terms of knowing how to fight back.
Yeah.
And we've spent the last 10 years, Mandate had a strategic review 2005-06. And from that strategic review, we built a training center. We've been investing in activists and letting them understand, you know, not only their own individual rights, which are important, right? But the most important thing about trade unions and the bread and butter, I think, for trade unions is letting them understand the power that they have as a collective.
Yes.
Because, we can win. Again, I've written an article today on the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation
now,
blog.
Now, tell us a little bit about this article. You were telling me a bit about it. Very. Go on, fill us in a bit on
that. I was asked to write something about Brexit and about the EU and the EU's relationship to workers' rights. And everyone in Ireland, and they're right, by the way, I'm not criticising this, but everyone says, oh, without the EU, we'd still have the marriage bar, we wouldn't have lunch breaks, we'd be, you know, all that sort of stuff. You know, we get, you know, the Organisation Working Time Act and a lot of pieces of legislation that came from Europe. It did. But it came from Europe at a time, 1973, when Ireland joined Europe in 1973, trade union density levels across Europe were at 46%. They're currently at 23%, right? So the decline of trade unions all across Europe and the decline in industrial action all across Europe as well has led to a new group of people ruling the roost over in Brussels, right? Unions used to be a power to be reckoned with. They're no longer a power to be reckoned with. So can you name the last piece of legislation we got that was positive in terms of workers' rights through Europe? Because it's a long time since we've had one, right?
And we've actually done more in this country than we have.
We have
in
now.
The EU.
Now, so great. 70s, they were brilliant. The EU did great work and we got great individual rights. We've got no collective rights from Europe. And in fact, the Viking Laval rulings, the Luxembourg rulings, the European Court of Justice has ruled against collective action on numerous occasions, right? So people saying, you know, the EU is brilliant and Britain are mental to be leaving it and all these stupid idiots for vote for Brexit. When you look at the facts, right, here's a fact for you, right, that people you'll never hear in Ireland or in the UK. When the UK joined the EU, the previous years up to the war, 1945 all the way up to 1973, their average unemployment rate was 2.3%. It's now, since it joined the EU, 7.2%. The EU is great for jobs, right? Ireland's unemployment rate pre-joining the EU, average, 5.5%. It's now up at 10.5% since 1973. An average unemployment rate during the time we've been in the EU of 10.5%. And people keep telling us that the EU is great. It's brilliant for jobs. And it's brilliant for workers' rights. It hasn't been. It's been great for individual rights. But we still, in Ireland, more than 100 years after the lockout, still do not have the right to collectively bargain in Ireland.
Yes.
And very restrictive rights around striking. The Dunstores anti-apartheid strike in the 1980s, where they went on strike for the right to not handle South African goods, that would be illegal today. Because the 1990 Industrial Relations Act was brought in as part of that partnership agreement, drafted as part of the partnership agreement, to prevent workers from political strikes. So when the water charges dispute was on, when you're talking about the taxation marches and all the rest of that, all those workers who went on strike at that time, if they did that now, they'd be sacked and there'd be no recourse to unfair dismissals. So when we win ballots for industrial action in Tesco or in Dunnes or wherever, we win them on the basis that, look, you can't be sacked for taking industrial action. We go to our members and we say, we want a national strike, you know, about housing, about taxation, about water charges. But here, just know this, they can sack you and there's nothing we can do about it.
That's
what
true.
That 1990 Industrial Relations Act was about, preventing people from being organised outside of their workplace.
That's right, outside of their work. And it came up, I think it may have been with the Lewis workers, it came up on their strike, this phrase, wildcat strikes came up. And I really disliked how they were using wildcat strikes. So I went to the journal Fact Check. And I said, no, what they're calling wildcat strikes are not wildcat strikes. Because, as you said, a wildcat strike can get you fired. Mm-hmm. And it can get you fired. So it's very important that you control the language that they use. So when you have politicians coming out and saying, these are wildcat strikes, first of all, you got to say, okay, prove it's a wildcat strike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I went to the fact check and I was right. They could not call them wildcat strikes. Yeah. So you have to be very, very careful about the language you use about strikes these days. Extremely careful.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about all this stuff is, and it goes to your question you were asking a couple of minutes ago about why unions aren't out front and center on a lot of this stuff. And the, you know, wages as a proportion of the economy have gone down. Unemployment has gone up. Higher underemployment, you know, we have the second highest underemployment in Europe. Poverty rates are increased. It's because the rules are stacked against organised workers, against trade unions. There's a big campaign on at the moment in Australia called Change the Rules. They're literally saying that. They're saying the rules are stacked against workers. We need to tip the balance in favour of workers. So they're seeking, you know, much stronger, not individual rights, but rights to get organised, to stop the victimisation of people who join trade unions and take industrial action. We've just finished last week. We went on strike in February 2017, 2.5 years ago. And the last case of victimization by Tesco, when those workers went back in, the last case was just finished last week. Like, one of our members went, took industrial action. Well, he didn't even take industrial action. On a day off, he joined the picket line of the store. And they say he brought the company into disrepute. And they were able to drag him through the courts for 2.5 years, wondering, you know, what's going to happen to him. That has happened to 80 different people. Tesco workers by the company have been told they can't communicate with each other about the company in private messages Facebook.
I saw that
it's
before.
It's incredible stuff.
I have seen workers dragged into court, injuncted. Mm-hmm. I have seen them told that they can't discuss it with other workers, with their colleagues, that they can't. And I've seen that firsthand. Mm-hmm. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And a lot of it goes under the radar. Mm-hmm. A lot of it people don't know about. But there is... As you said, there are employers' unions, and employers' unions are far more active at making sure that employees don't stand up for themselves than employee unions are at making sure employer unions don't stand
up for themselves. And even more than that, employer unions are still politically active, where employees' unions are less politically active. They are in having briefings in Boswells across the road from the Dáil. Every second week, employers have TDs coming in for a little breakfast, having cups of coffee, tea, and being told, by the way, this Employment Miscellaneous Provisions Act, we don't like that. We think you should do X, Y, Z. Unions don't do that.
Two of the three top lobbyists, the numbers wise, when you come back, two of the three top lobbyists that get access to government more than any are employers' unions. Mm-hmm. Are employers' unions.
So hang on, this is obviously all terrible. But the key question remains, which I don't think has been addressed yet, as to why people of my... So I'm, what, 24? I was never thought about a union, bar like one thing in CSPE. Since I've gone into the workforce, there's been nothing about trade unions, been nothing about the benefits of trade unions. So why are my generation, and I don't speak for all of my generation, but why are my generation not interested in trade unions? Are they perceived as being weak because the scales are tipped so far in the balance of the employers? Like, what's the benefit to me joining a union now? It would be the question I would be asking.
Yeah, we get this a lot. I don't know where you work. I don't know the business. We generally organise, so Paddy Power workers, Lloyd's pharmacy workers. These are all greenfield sites, for want of a better phrase, places where an employee, one person has come to us and said, look, this is what's going on here. And we've gone out and organised those workers and those particular employments. It's much more harder for us to convince people in small businesses or...
private sector?
No, we're completely private sector. Yes, we're entirely sector union. We don't have any public sector members at all. But it's... When people work in a business of 5 or 10 people, a corner shop or whatever, they don't want to be seen to be the rocking the boat in a lot of places, right? Young people today, a lot of them are working in industries that are not organized traditionally, right? So the vast majority of our members are in Penny's, in Tesco, Super Value, which was Super Quinn. They were all organized. Those workplaces were organized in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And we are now the hangover of that to a large degree. Like, if we didn't have those industries, we wouldn't exist as a union, those employments. Paddy Power and Lloyd's and a couple of the others that we've been organizing are a complete anomaly, because the employer has been treating the workers so bad that the workers are getting themselves organized. It's not us going out there knocking on doors and saying, do you want to join? They came to us. But, what I'd say is, and this is a lot of my mates are always, why would I join a union? I don't need one. And, you know, the water charges thing, that wouldn't have happened without the trade union involvement. Mm-hmm. The unions funded that whole campaign. Well, 95% of the funding, right? We coordinated it. We drove it. We got, all the research done. We did the submissions, for a lot of stuff. Our members are now better off. I calculated it a while ago. the original water charges plan was 500 euros, 500 to 600 euros, an average household was going to pay in water charges. And then they reduced it to 260. It was going to cost our members 27 million euros a year. And now there's no water charges in there, 27 million euros every year better off as a result of that campaign. So they've saved themselves almost €100 million, right? And I say, that's the benefits of us being active politically. But they've also won pay increases during that period of time. So we did a piece of research 2-3 years ago. Workers in unionized employments in retail, in the area we look after, retail and bar. So workers in those places we've organized, the workers, are paid 30% more than people in non-union sector. Like, it's a huge difference. But the problem is, how do we get to industries and people who are not in those traditional sectors of getting organized? It's a big challenge. You tell me, what would make you join a union?
I don't know. I feel like, I mean, like,
would 30% pay increase?
30% would. I find it hard because in a sector, say, like my sector is advertising, I don't know where to go.
So it is, you guys. We were sales and we're a product of a number of amalgamations, but there was a sales and marketing union.
So why have I not seen? I know it's not, it's my job to do the research. I get that. But why is nobody, it perceived to be nobody, why is nobody pushing this in college when that's when the workforce is being trained? Why is nobody pushing this on social media about, hey, you're in a union, you could get 30% more than you're in. You could get insurance, housing insurance, car insurance. You could get all these. Why have I not seen that?
We live in a state that is fundamentally opposed to organised workers and always has been. We've never had a government that said, you know what, this is a good thing. Everything we've got has been won by workers here on strike or trade unions across Europe threatening the EU. Everything is given reluctantly. There's no such thing as a benevolent government in Ireland that said, you know what, I'm going to give them, you know, extra lunch breaks or whatever it is. We have to get organized. So who drafts the curriculum of school? You know, we study economics, accounting, all sorts of things that some people might need after, right? We've learned French, which you might need if you go travel. One thing that every worker, I believe, needs, you go out into the real world and, you know, you're living in poverty. You might not be able to feed your children 1 week, or you might be becoming homeless or whatever. And they've never told you that you would be paid better if you were in a union. You know, there's, to me, it should be a core part of the curriculum. We should understand trade unions, collectivism, industrial relations, workplace rights. All of that stuff should be taught, you know. And I don't mean just thrown out there as here's a day, lads.
In fairness, the lockout is thought. And in fairness, the lockout, but that's where the Irish government draws the line. It goes, and we had the lockout, so unions were happy when that was all resolved. And now here we are. And that's how that works, is that it stopped at that point, that it just never went any further than that point. You're asking why should, you know, how do you get introduced to these things? Greenfields, and I said this 20 years ago as a union delegate, I said it, Greenfield and what you do, you got to go out, unions have to go out and organize Greenfield. It's very difficult. You will come up against huge opposition, huge. But again, if you work collectively as workers with a union, you can do it. I've been on all sides of that coin. I've been the manager, I've been the union rep, I've been the union member. The best place I ever worked in, the best place, the most productive in all senses, I mean, best for management, best for workers, was a highly organized union place. Highly, highly organized. Everybody knew the rules. Everybody knew the rules. And it was much easier for me as a manager. It was much easier for them as a worker. Ego didn't come into it. It just didn't come into it. And when you're in a working in an atmosphere like that, you can be really productive, really, really productive. And that's what I found amazing, coming from what I would call Schedule D work. They call them Schedule D workers, who have absolutely no rights whatsoever, to a unionized shop. Where there was, you know, a couple of hundred workers, where everybody understood the rules, and then I got promoted, so I had to switch to the other side, and I switched to the other side, but it was so much easier for me, having coming off a union background, to be able to work within the rules and achieve what the boss wanted me to achieve. And it was just so much easier. It made life way easier.
We have a mixture of different types of employments. We've got places where we do deals with the employer and they are respectful, and we've got forums so they can, things can be resolved at a local level. Got those types of relationships. You've got other ones where the company really doesn't want to be there, but they have to be there because we're so well organized. And then we've got those fundamentally opposed to sitting down with us. Tesco haven't sat down with us in years, right? Dunstores haven't sat down with us since 1996. Paddy Power, Lloyd's Pharmacy, TK Maxx, all of these places, which are all making phenomenal profits, leading to the biggest inequality gap we've ever had in this country as well, by the way. So Tesco CEO paid £4.9 million last year. Pounds, right?
Yeah.
And the workers are currently on, you know, at the highest rate of their, the low pay scale is $12.95 an hour. So it'll take a Tesco worker here just over almost 300 years to earn what he earns in 1 year, that CEO. Right?
And that's a massive change from where it was back, we'll say back in the late 50s, 1960s in America, where the CEO was on maybe 3 to 5 times what the worker was earning. It's also worth mentioning that the highest rate of tax at that stage was over 90%. Yeah. It was over 90%. So when you get, you know, the neoliberals telling you, taxes are too high, we need, please cut the fuck on.
Taxes,
you know,
are not high enough.
Exactly, yeah. AOC, Alexandria Cortez, with her plans for a 70% tax. Well, they all went mental over it. You know, you can't have this. It'll ruin the nation. This is the really interesting thing, is Donald Trump's running around saying, make America great again. That period of time that he's talking about there is the 50s and 60s and 70s when they had 90% tax rates. She's not even calling for that make America great again. Like, she's calling for 20% below that, and she's been ridiculed for it and told that she's economically illiterate, irrespective of the fact that there's a heap of Nobel economics winners who are backing her and saying, yeah, this is the optimum amount that you should pay. So I asked a couple of economists that I know, what would that mean in Ireland if we brought in the 70% that she's arguing for people, say, earning over 100 grand, we would have an extra 2.9 billion euros to spend if they had the will to bring in that third tax rate at 70%. Now, 2.9 billion would build you almost
half a children's hospital.
Yeah, before the overspends. But no, it would build you probably about 10,000 houses, I think. So, I mean, it's not to be sneezed at, but why is nobody, even on the left and the unions, nobody's talking about this? Why can America, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Cortez, Jeremy Corbyn over in the UK talking about higher tax rates, and in Ireland, the left is silent about let's have higher taxes? Nobody wants to go down that road of higher taxes.
To a large part, if you talk to, and you know, and this really does bother me, when you talk to Irish people, they'll tell you Ireland is a high tax economy.
Nonsense.
Or a high tax society. And it's complete bumpkin. Yeah. It's absolute bumpkin. It's complete nonsense. But you will hear, I mean, as I said to you earlier, I turned on a radio show in Ireland and I spent 15 seconds listening to it. And I ended up cursing and turning it off again because they just trot out this crap like it's actually real. And it's not real. We are not a high tax country. Nowhere near a high tax country. Dave, we're running on time, so I'm going to ask you, trade union membership, the future. What way do you see this going? Do you think it needs to get worse before it gets better?
It can't get much worse, to be honest. The private sector in Ireland is about 14-15% density levels. You know, we had density levels in 1976, which was the highest year on record, of about 58%. And it's down to 23%, including public and private sector, right? So serious decline. Fastest decline, I think, in Europe. We've had the fastest decline in wages as a proportion of GDP in the entire OECD bar Mexico, right? I think Mexico is the only country that declined quicker than we did. And that goes in line with the decline in trade unions. I think we need a strategy in the trade union movement, a complete reshape of how we do business, what we do. And that would start with a fair work campaign. A campaign to rebalance the rules that allow people into unions and allow them. So three elements to it in my mind. One, make it easier for people to join trade unions. So I'm seeking a couple of pieces of legislation at the moment that would make it easier for people to join trade unions. Second is make it easier for them to actually get a collective bargaining agreement. At the moment, it's a voluntary system. So employers can volunteer to do business or not. So they're all volunteering not to do it. So the voluntarist system is dead. It doesn't exist anymore, right? So make it easier to join, make it easier to collectively bargain, and make it easier to strike. And if you put those three pieces together into a Fair Work Act or some sort of piece of legislation around that, that you will see a rejuvenation of the trade union movement. The reason we're finding it so hard to organise workers is fear of taking action, fear of being found out to even be a member of a trade union. So people join and we've a system, you know, silent member. Like, we can't tell anybody that they're there. You know, if anyone rings, or, you know, we have to have that system in place because people are so scared of what their employer will, which I think says a lot about what workers' rights are like at the moment. You think about IKEA just down the road there, right? IKEA have an agreement with every supplier in the world that they have, that they must recognise trade unions in every country yeah. that they exist in, right? IKEA won't recognise mandate in Ireland. IKEA has removed our organisers from the car park of IKEA for trying to talk to workers about their rights at work.
Yeah.
Told them, go out to the M50, and if you see any of our staff out there on the M50, feel free to flag them down and talk to them on the M50, but you can't talk to them in here. This is our property. So we need to change the laws, make it easier for people to join trade unions. And the big part of that, the most important part, is the right to access. As a trade union official over in Australia, my daily routine was I'd arrive in at 10 o'clock in the morning and fax any company anywhere in Australia the following 24 hours notice. Next day, I can arrive into that business and the company must provide me with a room
to sit
in, that workers can come in and talk to me about what's happening to them at work, individually, collectively, all sorts of things. And I can talk to them about, you know what, if you can get everybody in this factory to join the union, we're going to negotiate a pay increase for you. Don't know what it is, can't guarantee, but we will make that company sit down with us, open up its books, we'll see what the profit levels are, and we'll make sure you get a fair share of those profits. We need that here now, because if Ireland's retailers are making more profits here than any other country anywhere
We are the profit haven number one.
Yeah.
Best in the world.
Tesco referred to us in the past as Treasure Island.
Yeah.
Right?
And we now have the riots doing the same, saying the exact same. We are Treasure Island.
Yeah. So the capacity for workers to have a decent standard of living in Ireland is huge, because the profit levels can be eaten into by workers winning pay increases, which you'd think that the state would be going, that's great. Because if a worker wins a pay increase, what will happen? We get higher RSI, higher PAYE. Yeah. We'll be able to build more houses. But we don't. We have a government right now, and all previous governments, successive governments, have been about how do we make sure the unions don't have a voice? How do we make sure workers cannot get access to collective bargaining, cannot access strikes? So in order to do this, and the question that you asked, you know, the future for the trade union movement, we need a grassroots mobilisation similar to something like the Right to Water campaign. We need it in every town and village in the country, where young people are coming together and saying, we want, whether it's our employer, the sector or the industry that we're organised in, or a national agreement around these things, we want to be heard. We want our voices heard at work, and we want, in order to do that, we're obviously going to have to, you know, threaten a national strike of some sort, because it's not going to happen. Or else we're going to have to put in place a government that's going to do what workers want.
Well, that says that collective bargaining, proper collective bargaining, works for all sides. Mm-hmm. Okay, a little less profit, but you have a better society, and it's much easier to operate in a better society. Rachel, are you convinced?
Might join a union. Probably will join a union now after all that.
Make sure it's mandate.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
www.joinmandate.ie.
I'm not saying he has the forms in his back pocket, but I did.
I wouldn't be surprised if he did, to be honest.
Guys, thank you for coming in and having a chat. That was really good. That is a conversation you will not hear on mainstream radio. You will not hear that conversation. They won't let me near it. Look, Tortoiseshack does these conversations that you won't hear anybody else. We're entirely funded by patrons, so please go to www.tortoiseshack.ie and sign up as a patron, and you might just hear more of these conversations. Thanks very much indeed. Bye.